Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
Today's episode is a little different than our normal episodes. We have an interview with Mas Masumoto. Mas is here to discuss his new book, Secret Harvest. We dig into the details of the book, as well as some of its implications for Fresno. And then we close with what we're loving this week. Mas, I have a simple question to start. How are you so prolific?
One thing about farming is that you spend a lot of time by yourself. And when you spend a lot of time by yourself, you're able to think. And I reflect a lot. And I think writing is really about reflection. You allow your thoughts to go from one idea to another. And out in the fields is where I do most of my writing. I literally take a notepad and write things. I used to write things in the dust on a tractor, if I'm driving a tractor. The only problem is by the end of the road, the dust covered the note that I wrote on the fender or something like that, which was actually probably appropriate because it was like writing bad poetry. But anyway, I do a lot of thinking and note-taking out in the fields. And that's as an artist sketching and then takes it into his or her studio to do it. That's where I then bring it back to my basement office. And that's where I do my writing here.
Hmm. A lot of your books relate to your family, telling family stories. There's obviously challenges and opportunities with writing about your family. Can you talk about each of those? And do you think more people should be writing about their family stories?
I think family stories became so important to me because they're the central part of my life, especially when you do a family farm. It automatically implies you're working with the legacy, the history of the land, the dirt, what my father did. My grandparents were farm workers. They left their fingerprints on this land, so I couldn't help but incorporate that not only into my livelihood as a farmer and raising, growing organic peaches, nectarines, and grapes, but also the idea of it's embedded in the stories that I think about too. It's interesting because when I first started writing, I thought I'd be more of a short story writer or maybe even a bad poet, and I was a very bad poet. My early poetry sounded like bad country songs where you talked about you took my heart and stomped on it type stuff. But then I would write these short stories, and the irony is they were actually nonfiction. They were actually based on truth. And I had trouble expanding a story of a character and do something differently than what really happened. So I began to write about real life. And I think most of us think in terms of real life. And that's where it begins. And I think that's why I started writing so much about my family, about the land that we work and live in, and the community that's part of who I am.
Yeah. Before we jump in, let's go ahead and jump in. So can you talk to us a little bit about the impetus to write this book? And was writing it different than some of your other books in terms of the thematic content you're dealing with? And what were you hoping to impart to your readers?
This was the hardest book I've ever written because it talks about family, and family secrets imply there was something that wasn't being said, and you want to explore why it wasn't said and what was the true meaning behind it. So because I work in the realm of creative nonfiction, I couldn't make up things. So this book is about a lost aunt that we discovered, and I had only heard about her and thought we all thought she had passed away. And 70 years later, after 1942, she was alive in Fresno. And just that fact made me realize that I have to approach this like a story, because it wasn't something that I could just immediately figure out what happened. So I had to talk to family members, which was hard, because I remember the discussion I had with my mom. I sat her down. I said, "Mom, do you remember Aunt Shizuko?" And my mom said, "Yeah, she passed away years ago." And I said, "Mom, take a deep breath. She's alive in Fresno." And it was just that moment that you're speaking the truth and you understand the silence in my mom at the same time. And part of my quest was to understand, what did that silence mean? Was it that she felt ashamed about it, guilty about it? Was she thrilled and shocked about all this news? All of that was true. That was all part of this family story. So when you explore something like this, and this is why it was such a hard book for me to write, you had to explore these nuances of meaning and understand the context of them. Because it would have been easy for me to make judgment saying, how can you just not forget about your sister? And how can you forget about that? I wasn't there in World War II when all the Japanese were deemed the enemy. I wasn't there to try to live with a sibling that had a mental disability back in the 1920s and 30s when everybody hid that kind of aspect. To understand the context of history was part of the story I was writing.
So I guess our next question gets more into the specifics of Secret Harvest. Also, I'll introduce myself. I'm Juliana. I'm one of the reporters at Fresno Land. So in Secret Harvests, we see that by the time you meet Shizuko, that she's mostly nonverbal due to her disability resulting from untreated meningitis in her youth, and that you had been separated for 7 years. And I wanted to ask, was it intimidating taking on the task of telling her story without being able to have conversations with her, and how did you navigate that?
One thing to think about when you deal with family secrets, it all is about sequences, steps. You don't, it's not like this nice TV show with investigative journalists and they tell everything all at once as if they figured it out all at once. No, it's sequential. So everything from going to visit Shizuko for the first time, I still wasn't sure this was really my aunt. Was there a mistake in the documentation that could have happened and things like that? And the fact that when we first met her, she was in a coma because she had suffered a stroke. And in an interesting way, it was like, oh, this makes a nice closure that we found her before she died and she's going to pass away. Here is the irony. She had this in a coma for about 3 months. The wonderful caregivers around her, this wasn't a certain ICU unit or something where they took care of her. This was an adult daycare center, and they took wonderful care of her. She woke up after 3 months. So then there was the second phase of now there's the alive and active Shizuko we have to grapple with again. All of that was in steps, and that sequential steps in an amazing way allowed me to grapple with these different levels of inquiry and ask questions in a different way. If we found her and she had just passed away, you would have asked your 10, 20 questions and it would have been ended. But because she didn't, it was this whole sequence of, okay, what's next? What's the next question to ask? And because she couldn't talk, it was one of the big questions of, wait a minute, could she not talk because of her mental disability that she had? Or was the fact that she probably never learned English? Ah, I hadn't thought about that idea. Okay, could I write something to her in Japanese? She was probably illiterate. Ah, it throws you back to that moment in time when a lot of Americans, especially lower class, were illiterate. Because you had to get an education for many people, poor people, ethnic people, and especially someone with disabilities, was off the radar screen. They weren't going to go to school. And you go, huh, I hadn't thought about that we live in a different era. So it helps frame those times and those moments to understand that kind of dynamic of this story that's unfolding and continues to unfold.
I saw that in an interview with Civil Eats, you shared something about a friend who read an early draft of Secret Harvests and said, Moss, this book isn't about your aunt, it's about you. I was wondering, was it also difficult to navigate that balance between how much to center the story on Shizuko, who doesn't necessarily have the ability to tell her own story in her own words through writing or other means? And how much to focus the story on you and your experiences.
Juliana, as a journalist, you want to tell the story and you tend to not think about the story as part of you too. Initially, it's, oh, I'm just going to tell her story. And then I would just be the good investigative reporter on that. But at a certain point, suddenly I got thrown into this. And when I had a friend who read a first early draft and said, you're missing the point of this. This isn't just about Shizuko because there is so much unknown about her. We didn't have records when she was born in 1925 through the Great Depression. There were no written records of who she was. We had no photograph of her. Very limited memories. And then once she had became a ward of the state, there were no records that we had. A few documents of where she may have been, but that was it. So there was a lot of unknowns. And I thought, okay, maybe this makes a great story about unknowns. The story was really about how does my family grapple with unknowns? And that's why the heart of this book is about family secrets. the family secrets that are often silent in our families. The real question is not just what was kept secret, but why and how. And those are the key questions in life to ask, that follow-up question of why was it secret? How did you feel about it? And that's when you get to those family conversations that you're often met with silence, which is part of the answer. And then it's up to you as the good writer to say, I'm going to ask this question at Thanksgiving. I'm going to ask this question at the next family gathering. I'm going to ask my aunt about this because I know my uncle won't say anything about it. And you find out these other dynamics. And that's how this story unfolded over years, literally talking to some cousins. And one cousin pulled me aside and she said, my dad, my uncle, went to go see Shizuko after the family came back from the relocation camps. And I said, no, my mom, my uncle's sister, said no one saw her. No, this was another secret. They went to go see her. And that was one of the chapters in the book. They went to go see her and found out that she was actually being taken care of better than they could take care of her because they had just come back from 4 years of being in prison. They had nothing, no money, no food, no shelter. And her Shizuko, as a ward of the state, was at least being fed and at least had shelter. So that was another secret that came out. I went, I had no idea. And it took my cousin to tell me that because she was sworn to secrecy at the same time. So again, it's part of that sequential aspect of asking those hard questions over and over.
Moss, it feels a little bit like you're trying to instigate all of us to start uncovering our own family secrets and have really uncomfortable Thanksgiving conversations. Which,
yeah, I was going to say, is this a script for my Thanksgiving, Moss? Because I don't know.
We're about to get really uncomfortable with our parents and grandparents.
You'll find, though, sometimes those are amazing conversations, right? Because someone will say something and then suddenly you get pulled into the kitchen and the aunt who didn't want to say anything will say something almost whisper like to you. And you go, ah, okay. Or someone then will later come back and you say, here's a letter. And you find out there was this family letter, this document that everyone had hidden. And those are the, I think, the wonderful things. Or you might have the uncle who had maybe a little too much wine with the Thanksgiving dinner that blurts out some stuff and it starts this other crazy conversation. And sometimes it's not bad.
I feel like for a lot of families, there's this fear that if you uncover the secret, that it brings shame to the family. And you obviously deeply covered the topic of shame throughout the book, which I thought was super relatable. And I'm just curious, in the process of digging into your own family secrets and really looking at shame face to face throughout the book, how has that changed your own perspective in life on different topics that are covered or not covered?
One of the challenges was I began to realize I was looking at all this family story, family legacy, family secrets through the context of today, to think of what is today's standards of dealing with mental disabilities and an intellectual disability. And I realized, wait a minute, things were different in 1925 and 1930s. And also realized that I never grew up that poor that my immigrant grandparents did when they first arrived here, and start developing not just an understanding, but a type of empathy for that I can't fully grasp because I was never hungry in my life. And when you begin to realize that, you think, huh, that had to affect decision-making, that had to affect people's attitudes. And then, of course, World War II, and my mom was 13, and suddenly she was deemed the enemy. And you have to go, I don't quite understand what that's. And yet that's happening in today's world, but it's hard to develop that kind of understanding and empathy for it. But you can ask questions about it. And I think that was the key, and that was part of grappling with shame. I could understand shame in today's context, but what was shameful back in the 1930s when you had a child, a sibling that had an intellectual disability, and understand, huh, okay. And for example, back then they had the country and cities often passed ugly laws. And that's where they did not want people with a mental disability seen in public, because it was shameful for not only just a family, but for a community in a city. So that's why so many people with mental disabilities were kept hidden, locked inside. And you understand that was part of that era, part of that time, doesn't mean it was right or wrong. It just meant that was what was the standard. It's no different than when we think of race relations or issues of religion, for example, and you grew up a certain pattern, but then in a certain era, it was wrong to be a Catholic or wrong to be a Protestant or wrong to be black or wrong to be white or wrong to be an immigrant or whatever. And people hid those stories. I'll tell you a really quick story. My wife's family is from Wisconsin, right? Big German population. And I got to meet her grandmother, who was wonderful to talk with. And in a funny way, we bonded because she understood what it was to be like, especially during war and being the enemy. So she talked about World War I. She grew up in a household that spoke German. And she said, we spoke low German, which is more the working class German, not the higher class. And she remembered going to school around when World War I broke out. And suddenly her classmates told her, you have to stop speaking German. She goes, that's what we talk all the time. She goes, no, it's wrong to speak German. And it perplexed her as a child. And she still carried that story with her to share it with me. And to understand that dynamic of here, you were American, you were white, but you were German speaking, it was wrong. And you have to put that in context. And I remember her shaking her head because she was from a working class dairy farm family in Wisconsin. And suddenly they were worried about being perceived as the enemy because they spoke German. So those are the contexts of those stories that deal with something as simple as language and shame. And that's part of her history. And here I was, years, decades later, Japanese American, and she's sharing this story with me. And it was just a fascinating moment.
When you were trying to get a more complete picture of the context back then in like the 30s and so on, what were some of the most like shocking things you learned about any of the topics you cover, whether it's like disability rights or other topics?
It was so hard to project of what it was like, because I obviously was born after a different time and era. My family and most people tend to try to put a sort of brighter light on it and overlook the really tough times. And yet we live in a world, especially now, that thrives on bad, that loves bad news. It makes the headline. You look at your daily news and it's driven by the power of bad. And yet these stories on a family level and a personal level, you have to try to keep those bad stories in check because you need to move on. And that probably struck me the most. I don't know how I would have grappled with any of that. I possibly would have given up. And I'm sure that happened in many cases. For example, it's rarely talked about, but during the Great Depression in the 1930s, families gave up children because they couldn't feed them. And you hear about these orphans or somebody just drops somebody off with maybe a distant relative and they suddenly raise them. Or the reverse happened. People in the cities suddenly took their kids out to the country and they were raised on this farm because at least they had maybe some milk and some food that they grew on the farm. They weren't starving as they did in the cities. So those type of dynamics unfolded. And it was really hard to put those in context until, getting back to that original question that you had asked, how do I grapple with that? And isn't this story then a lot about me and how my perception is? And one of the key points of this was it shifted how I asked questions. It wasn't just what happened. It was suddenly why and how that happened. And then the third or fourth question of sometimes pointed questions of why didn't you do something differently? Or another question of, did you ever think what you did was right or wrong? And these are hard questions. And it's amazing how my family gave their answers to these different kind of questions. I was softer than maybe a good journalist could be on asking these questions, but sometimes it was nuanced. I'll tell you one thing that really struck me, and I've always grown up with this too. It was the power of silence. You ask a question and someone responds in silence, and that's the answer. And what's embedded in that, I think that's what makes for a good story, because that silence is part of that story.
We're going to talk about a couple things related to internment now. For background purposes, can you talk a little bit about the Fresno Fairgrounds and how it was used for internment? I know we have a couple other questions, but I want to start with kind of some basic facts for people. Mm-hmm.
People may not realize, but the Japanese American internment came in phases. There was Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. Executive Order 9066 was signed in February of 1942, which meant that all Japanese Americans were going to be called the enemy. And then phases unfolded. First, there was a curfew of Japanese Americans on the coast. So people thought if we lived 3 miles from the coast, we're safe. And then Highway 99 became a dividing line. There was this, it sounds insane now, but it's the idea that if you lived west of 99, you were the enemy. So you had to move east of 99. And it just so happened that, like for my family, where they were working as farm workers, they were east of 99. But anyone who lived west of 99, for example, if you lived in Hanford or Carruthers or something like that, you had to be interned into the assembly center. And the Fresno Fairgrounds became that. They lived in the horse stables there. They were created around, I believe, maybe March or April of 1942. My mom would tell a story. She'd go visit friends that lived in this, and they were behind bars, behind wires and fences. And my mom would just walk in to visit them and then leave, saying, "This is just a wild moment of history." That happened because there was a graduation of Japanese Americans at the Fresno Fairgrounds in June of 1942. And people thought, okay, this would be it. There's an article I remember reading. A lot of Japanese Americans in LA wanted to move to Reedley. And Reedley was a large Japanese American community, and it was east of 99. And they thought that's where they'd spend the rest of the war. Then by August, the complete internment unfolded, and all Japanese Americans were barred from living in the West Coast. So it went through stages like that. And it's interesting to think about that, because perhaps if they had done an initial total ban, there would have been enough pushback. But because it went through stages, it was almost more acceptable. And there was not this huge protest because, as I said, my family for a while thought that they were safe because they lived east of 99. And that's why the Fresno Fairgrounds became this odd collection of a moment in history. And Pinedale Assembly Center, they call these assembly centers. Pinedale Assembly Center was the same, where they brought people from Western Washington into the heat of summer in Fresno of 1942. And that's where they spent that. And then in August, they all got their marching orders to literally go to inland points of America from the Arizona desert to Jerome, Arkansas, for example, because that's where the government thought they could secure this enemy population.
And I was really struck in the book you referencing that there was a little bit of local pushback to the incarceration of local Japanese Americans, but only to finish the raisin harvest.
Yeah.
That was wild to me. And did you hear stories about this from your family, or how did you learn that detail?
I heard just a little about that. For example, when I was doing some research years ago, the Selma Enterprise had an editor who said, "This is wrong." And I thought, this is great. And again, middle of a war, And a journalist had the guts to say, "This is wrong," when they're surrounded by all the other media saying that, no, we need to get rid of these people. And then I stumbled on a chart that looked at the raisin prices of raisins in America. And during the Great Depression, they're really low. Then when the war broke out, the government needed to subsidize farm industries because they needed this food for rations. Raisins were great in rations for soldiers because they didn't need to be refrigerated, high sugar content, easy to transport, etc. So the raisin price doubled during the war. I read a couple articles where it was the local Farm Bureau that said that, or the Farm Bureau of that era, said that, no, we should delay internment because we need to have the Japanese American finish harvesting the raisins, because where else are we going to get the workers? And then we'll lock them up in prison and stuff. I heard it that through backstories of, like, my father saying that they were renting some land, had grown all this crop, and when they had to be interned, they went to the landlord and said, "Hey, we have to leave in early August. You pick raisins in late August, early September. What are you going to do?" And they were powerless. So they got a few dollars for raising this crop, and my dad was just so mad. And this is my dad, who's very stoic, very quiet. He told me this story about how he was so mad he went out and a house that they were living in, all their possessions they had, they couldn't take with them. So he took them outside and he burned it. And I said, this is my quiet, passive dad doing this. And it just told the drama of that moment and try to understand that. I remember asking my aunt, had she heard of that story? And she looked down and she was quiet. And she goes, yeah, your dad sometimes was right. And I went, oh my goodness, what a response. Because she understood the dynamic of what was happening at that moment.
Yeah. One of the things that can last from internment is something we're understanding more in the mental health field, which is generational trauma. When I lived in San Francisco, I lived in a kind of a big house with a bunch of people renting. And the landlady that lived there was from Germany. And she was a small child in Dresden during World War II and survived the firebombing and then immigrated to the United States. And I remember one morning we were sitting at the breakfast table, 19-year-old me and this German landlady who was in her 70s, and I didn't finish my oatmeal and she screamed at me, and I had no reference point as to why. And then I later learned the story of her childhood and what she survived, but just me wasting food provoked something in her that attached to something that she had experienced. How does internment, how has it affected future generations, yourself and then your kids and going forward?
I affected it in a number of capacities. One was simply economic, because all these family farms who were starting to get on their feet and start buying farmland, our family was gonna buy a farm around that type in the early 40s, because there was like three or four brothers that were hungry for work, and we finally established. Plus, they were old enough now that there were these alien land laws that prevented the early immigrants, like my grandparents from Japan, from owning land. It was specifically targeted to Orientals, and they were ready to buy land. So there's this economic, this generational wealth that could have been embedded in buying a farm, buying a house, they could not do. So that impacted that era in terms of looking at that. And then there's certainly the social dynamic of being called the enemy. When my parents came back from the relocation camps, there was still trauma from the war. My mom would tell stories of running into a white family who had fought the war in Pacific, which was brutal, or even in Europe, but especially in the Pacific, where the Japanese were the enemy. And they would see someone who looks Oriental, Japanese, and they'd immediately think this is the enemy. And my mom told stories of running into things like that. And you understand that the trauma soldiers went through, and yet that continued today in my mom's lifetime. So she was still had the face of the enemy. And so she wore that. And that's why that whole generation wanted to become American. And that's what I grew up with. The idea is that you need to become American, whatever that meant. But part of it, ironically, was understanding that generational trauma that my family went through on the social level that then translated into a personal level. And a simple example of that is most of my generation, Sansei, third generation Japanese Americans, we grew up knowing very little about internment. No one talked about it. It was hidden. And the most I learned about when I started college, and I actually started reading more about it, I go, what? And went back to talk to my parents and my grandmother too about this, and understand that they just kept it a secret, because it gets back to Danielle's question about shame, that this was a shameful moment. Right or wrong, it was shameful, and you don't talk about that. So that silence became part of that generational trauma, that there was this hidden aspect of life, and it gets back to family secrets. Understand the context of those family secrets and then try to decipher them and ask those other questions so you understand more about that. So I think that's how generational trauma gets translated. And did it affect my attitudes? Oh, I think it did. I think when I was much younger, I was much more carefree about the world in a very wonderfully naive way. And as I grew older, I began to realize there are these pieces of all of our lives that we have to respect and honor. In that sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know I come from my dad's side of the family is German Mennonite farming family from Jinuba, and the internment of Japanese Americans in our part of that, which is very prominent, was never discussed, never once mentioned. And I have to just, I have so many questions about like how white families have processed that trauma and their role in that trauma as well. And
There are some interesting stories of how families did care, but they also but often it was on a very private, personal level.
Right.
There were stories of when our families, my family, got on the trains, boarded the train to head down to Gila River, Arizona, where they were going to be locked up in prison. Some Christian groups brought some snacks for them, some cupcakes and stuff for their train trip. And I thought, what an ironic moment where you're sending these people off to prison and you're bringing them treats, but they thought at least we could comfort them on a certain level. So it's this wild moment of, as a storyteller, how do you frame that? That these are people who are so callous that they're wishing these people goodbye, or they're really trying to show some compassion. Because they were helpless. This was a governmental order. They couldn't do anything, so they could do what little they could do. And I just keep flashing at that moment, thinking of that. If I was a movie producer, I'd like 18 scenes of that. One scene that it's a moment of true compassion, and another one is this twisted moment of naivete about what's happening to this world and stuff.
I think one thing that this also raises for me as a journalist is that there's a lot of erasure I've seen over the years of the protesting that happens in these major governmental decisions. And there's almost always a pretty strong group of people of.
We're going to transition now to talk about mental health a little bit before we close up.
Yeah, one thing that stood out to me too in Secret Harvest was when you were writing about the caregivers that played a big role in Shizuko's life, and also in sharing some of these anecdotes with you about her personality and what she experienced. I think in some of my coverage for Fresnoland, I've heard from some of those care workers that they feel like this unseen and unappreciated workforce. So I was wondering, what did you learn about caregivers in the writing of this book?
I think one way of framing caregivers is that they, right or wrong, unfairly have become invisible. They're often low paid, often people of color, often people with limited education, and they are then doing these amazing tasks to care for people. And we happen to live in a world, in a society that doesn't reward them. They don't get paid well. They're not honored much. They become invisible, just like the people they're caring for become invisible. So one of the notions I had in writing Secret Harvest is try to make this as visible as possible. And that's why I elevated this idea of caregivers and caregivers throughout my Aunt Shizuko's life. 70 years of caregivers I never knew of. I did some research where I went to Camp Grant up in Auburn, where my aunt was for a number of years. And she, I ran into, I got a link to a music teacher who taught at this facility. And this was a facility where they had 10,000 people with a mental illness disability, intellectual disability. And it was back in that era where you just put them all in the same asylum-like situation. And this music teacher said that she taught there for decades. Did she remember my aunt? No. Did she teach my aunt? Probably. But she told a story about how these adults with this intellectual disability, they'd get together these musical instruments and just start clanging them and clapping and doing all this kind of wild and crazy sound. And I said, "How did you deal with this as a music teacher?" And she said, "It was music to my ears." And you frame suddenly the heart that these caregivers have, and that's why they did what they do. And it, to me, it was part of the quest to highlight that and to realize that, yeah, this happened in Fresno. I drove by this facility my aunt was in for the last 10 years of her life. I just drove by it all the time, no idea that she was in there, let alone the work that the caregivers were doing. Another quick story where after my aunt passed away, I had made friends with some of the caregivers. So I would bring them peaches during their summer harvest and like 20 boxes of peaches. Our best peaches and leave them on a counter. And I remember this one woman said, "What is this?" And I said, "These are gifts for you because you took care of my aunt." And she looked at me, she said, "No one has ever given us a gift." And it just hit me that how sad the situation was, but yet that's the reality that this whole class of workers, this whole segment of our world are invisible, just like the patients that they're often taking care of are invisible too. And
Yeah.
that's where good writing. And that's where good writing, maybe, as you do in Fresnoland, could make that life visible for readers and people too.
Absolutely. One of the things that I'm thinking about a lot, and this has come up with some of the new homeless ordinances, we're thinking about institutionalization. So as you well know, in the 50s and 60s, there was growing criticism of these asylums or mental hospitals. I read The Bell Jar. I read One Flies Over the Cuckoo Nest, that scene where Jack Nicholson gets the lobotomy. Like that's just always stained in everyone's brain who's seen that movie. And the 1963 Community Mental Health Act tried to push people out of what were reasonably not the best places to be. A lot of these asylums are run poorly. They could have really poor discipline approaches to dealing with people. But then that put a lot of emphasis on families taking on family members that have severe mental illness. We see a lot of the challenges with that today, with a lot of people that are homeless that have mental health issues, and it's complicated to get them support. How do you think, just working on this book and thinking about your own family, how do you think about institutionalization? Do you see that as something that we need a more nuanced approach to? How do you think about it?
I think one of the big dynamics is all of this tends to be thrown into the realm of secrecy. You put someone away, they become invisible. Someone has a mental illness or a mental disability, intellectual disability, we just hide them. And that happens over and over. I think the first step is just to try to become more open about this, tell stories, write stories, for it to become part of our public conversation. That's the first step. As far as an answer for an organizational, I am pretty lost in that because it's such a huge issue. And more than if, for example, when I did readings and stuff, I would ask people to stop and think about their own families. And almost every family would stop and think, we had a family member, a sibling, a cousin, an aunt, an uncle, someone in the family that had an issue in terms of their intellectual capacity and stuff. I remember writing this book, my first draft, I shared it with this wonderful woman, Alice Wong, who is a leader in looking at disability rights. And she started saying, you got to change some of your language. And I said, you're right. And I went back through and realizing just little things I was saying were incorrect because I was framing it in a different way. And I write a passage in that when I grew up, we had the language of someone that had an intellectual disability. They were mentally retarded. And that was the language I grew up with. They were MRs, I remember, all the time. It just rolled off your tongue and everything like that. Where it was just the language that we used that people don't realize how it frames their thinking. And that's where all you folks are as writers understand that power of language frames how people think. And I think that's the first step. We need to change the type of conversations we have, which then in turn looks at things like homelessness, looks at things of poverty, intellectual disability, mental health in a different frame. And as soon as we start using that language, I think we'll begin to start opening our minds up to thinking about that and make it both public and also personal in that respect.
We're going to close today with our favorite segment, which is what we're loving this week. What I'm loving this week, I'm a big fan of the Great British Baking Show, and most American cooking shows are just like, they almost feel like children's shows where it's like intense, loud, there's a race, there's giant clocks on the wall, and it's hyperactive, it's stressful. I'm thinking of things like Cutthroat Kitchen. What I loved about the Great British Baking Show is it's so calm. It's like a screensaver, but it's just people baking and it's so soothing. And we finally have kind of an American version of that, and it's called the Blue Ribbon Bake Off, I think is the name. And it's just premiered on Netflix. And what it is it taps into baking at county fairs. And so it attaches to like the ribbons that you would get at a county fair. And it's just like the perfect compliment to the Great British Baking Show because it's so sweet and calm. And I grew up going to fairs and eating fair food. And so I attached like childhood memories to it. And it's just been a really soothing show to watch at the end of summer. And I've been loving that this week.
Oh, I love that idea, because one thing I like about the British show is that sometimes they cooperate. Sometimes they actually help each other. And I go, wait a minute, all the American shows are competitions. Yeah. You're supposed to almost sabotage the guy next to you. But in those shows, they actually will see someone struggling and they'll go, let me help you finish that or something, even though this might be the person that displaces you. I think that's a wonderful idea. And the reality is that's how life is. Most of us live in a cooperative world, not competitive world, even though our workplaces and everything from politics tend to be competitive. No, it's about cooperation.
Absolutely. Juliana, what are you loving this week?
So I think on a previous episode, I shared that I had just read Mouse, and I'm continuing with reading graphic novels and comics. So right now I'm reading Saga for the first time.
Ooh, I love Saga. Saga is great.
I'm almost done with book one, but yeah, who's my favorite character? I think the Will and the Lion.
Yeah,
it's a whole medium that I feel like I just haven't engaged with enough. This year is the year of the graphic novel and comic book for me, I think.
What about you, Donnie? What are you loving this week?
It's still summer. It's still hot. My family is always in search of the perfect, cool, sweet treat for the summer. This week we went to Raspados El Diablito Loco on Shields and West, and they have the best manganadas. Do you know manganadas?
I don't know what this is. Tell me.
It's fresh mango with mango sorbet. With chamoy,
okay.
Ooh. Mixed in with a chamoy straw, or sorry, a tamarind straw. And it's amazing. It's delicious. Go. Wow. Shields and West.
That sounds fantastic.
Fun.
Moss, what about you? What are you loving this week?
This is a totally different leap for me, but I've been in working with this project. I wrote a manuscript called The Music of Ghosts. And we're partnering with the Fresno Philharmonic, and they've commissioned two composers to write a musical composition based on this manuscript. And it's going to be performed February 15th and 16th as part of the Fresno Philharmonic shows and stuff. And this is totally out of my range, right? Where I played French horn in eighth grade, all right? That's the most of my musical background. And to hear the story transformed into music is just fascinating. And to be working with composers who actually, I don't work with them because I'm not a composer. It's just a new genre of this whole thing. And the fascinating things of, they came to visit the farm when this project started about two winters ago or two springs ago. And we stood around a peach tree that was blooming. And the question that was raised is, what's the sound of a peach blossom opening? And I started thinking more about that. And what's the literal sound, if there is a sound, but also what is the significance historically with that blossom opening? Does it mean hope? Does it mean a new spring that's arising? What does it mean for my family growing these peaches? Every spring they find new hope with it. And the manuscript talks about four generations of Japanese American farm women. And what did it mean through each generation to witness this? And also the other element was, what musical instrument would reflect the sound of a peach blossom opening? Is it the woodwinds? Is it the strings? Is it percussion? And how are they, as the composers, going to translate that? So I'm really looking forward to this project starting, continuing to come together, and then the performance in February.
Moss,
I'm so excited about that.
Me as well.
Keep you in touch with that.
Moss, we appreciate you so much for coming on. Again, the book is called Secret Harvest, A Hidden Story of Separation and the Resilience of a Family Farm. And I would encourage people to seek out a place other than Amazon to buy it, maybe. My favorite place to buy books is bookshop.org because it connects you to independent booksellers. But wherever you get it, pick it up. We all loved it, and we appreciate the stories you tell, your writing, and what you contribute to the Valley. So thanks again, Moss.
Oh, thank you. And again, thank you for Fresno Land for launching this book club. I think it's going to create conversations about the Valley and about Fresno. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thanks for listening, everyone. This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinum, and our song comes from Stateless Rat.